This episode of the Hope Podcast is brought to us by the Spotlight Project. The Spotlight Project is a fantastic organization run by fantastic people with the mission of raising employment for individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities. They create and sell beautiful jewelry, and each individual they employ has an intellectual or developmental disability and a unique story to tell. You can visit them at the Spotlight Project. Co.com. Again, the Spotlight Project Co.com. Use the coupon code HOPE, H-O-P-E. Again, use the coupon code HOPE for 15% off your order.
And with that, we'll turn it over to Kelly Caruso to tell her story.
Welcome everyone to this episode of the Hope Podcast. Really blessed and joined by my best friend in the world, Kelly Caruso. Kelly and I went to Quinnipiac together. That's where we met. We were in the same grade there, both played soccer, me for the men's team, Kelly for the women's team.
Thank you for putting that disclaimer in there.
Yeah, just making sure our friends on the same page. We're friends in college, got really close after college, and Kelly was a huge part of my story, of the company's story, and really, really grateful she was willing to come on the podcast and share her story with all of us. It's a powerful story, and Kelly's a great person, so really excited to chat with her. I'm really grateful she's here.
I'm really happy to be here. I know how much this whole company means to you, and it's been really cool to see how far you've come with it and all the good that you're doing for everyone. Mm-hmm. So, it's awesome.
I appreciate that.
Of course.
Appreciate that. So I guess we'll start at the beginning. If you want to talk a little bit about growing up in Connecticut, and just family life, friends life, and kind of some of the values and beliefs that your parents instilled in you.
Sure. Grew up in Connecticut, never really left. Went to college in Connecticut, obviously. But growing up, never had anything, you know, crazy happen in our family. Mm-hmm. Parents loved each other so much. Never saw them fight. You know, there were never any issues. But my parents were our biggest supporters. They came to every game that they could. I mean, I played soccer for 16 years of my life, and my dad was on the sidelines of, you know, every single game. Yeah, always happy times.
Awesome. And what did your parents both worked?
Right? Yeah.
What did they each do?
So my dad was a state attorney for 30 something years. Wow. So he worked for the state of Connecticut. And he retired in 2017. And then my mother works for Bank of America.
If you want to talk a little bit more about just kind of high school recruiting process, your decision to go to Quinnipiac, and any advice or, you know, guidance that your parents gave you during that process.
Dave at Quinnipiac, he's a coach in my premier club. So he's known me since I was 9. Mm-hmm. So to get recruited by Quinnipiac was kind of easier than a different school because he already knew me. He knew what type of player I was. He's been watching me play since I had been young. So it was kind of an easy process in that aspect, but definitely stressful. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was 15 or 16 in high school.
Right.
So basically I committed to Quinnipiac my junior year, and then my parents sat me down. They're like, all right, here's the course catalog. Pick a major. Like, here you go. Figure it out. So I ended up picking a major in health sciences, which didn't end up being for me, but I transferred into a different program within health sciences. So, you know, it all worked out, and it ended up being a great place for me to be. I just didn't know it at the time when I first committed.
So your parents were just kind of, they supported your decision for it. Did they kind of want you to stay close to home, or was it really, they just wanted you to do whatever you wanted to do?
They just wanted me to be happy and do what I wanted to do. They wanted me to keep playing because they loved watching me play.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they would have cared what school I went to, just as long as they could make it to the games.
Mm-hmm.
Which they did, and Quinnipiac was great because it was so close for them. I know my dad was a little upset when I changed majors. He didn't understand why I didn't want to be in my first picked major, which was PA. It was just not for me. And that's not something that you go into half-heartedly. Like, yeah. You have to know that you want to do that.
Yeah.
So he was kind of like, you know, why don't you just go to a 2-year college and you can get an ultrasound degree from there? But then I wouldn't have been able to play soccer. So once he understood all of that, he came around to the idea of me switching. And then he totally was on board with everything and was so proud.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. How did you find, like, was it a class you took that got you into, you know, diagnostic imaging and ultrasounds? Or, like, how did you decide? It's a little bit different.
It is different. I didn't really know anything about it, but my freshman year roommate was in the ultrasound program. Yeah. So when I started thinking of transferring into a different program, she started talking to me about the ultrasound program. So I met with some of the advisors and it just seemed like a good fit.
Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit more about kind of the people you met at Quinnipiac, like your teammates and just friends you made there. Just your experience at Quinnipiac in general.
Yeah, so I'd say when my mom first dropped me off for preseason, I'm pretty sure I cried the first night and called her to come pick me up. I told her I was dropping out. Classes hadn't even started yet.
Mm.
So definitely a homebody. So for me, having preseason to come into school and meet all my teammates and have those instant friends was huge.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think my whole freshman year, I only hung out with the soccer team.
Right.
So, you know, the other freshmen in my class, Joe, Laura, those were my best friends. That was my core group. And we did everything together and we spent so much time together. And then we ended up moving in sophomore year and we had 7 of us. And then we made some non-athletic friends, which was very helpful because mm-hmm. you definitely need space from your teammates.
Yep.
And then some of those girls became, you know, my best friends. You know, I have some different friend groups from Quinnipiac, but they're all so important to me. And I'm really glad that I found all those people there. Definitely worked out.
It's great to step outside of yourself and make friends outside of your circle. And even making friends like on a team is tough at first, mm-hmm. especially, you know, Joe and Laura, you didn't know them before. They came from different countries, definitely have different cultures and different personalities. But talk a little bit more about like your relationship with soccer and like what it meant to you and going through Quinnipiac, how it kind of either helped or didn't help your studies there. And then what it meant like losing it when you graduated and obviously weren't playing at a high level for the first time in your life.
Yeah. So, I mean, soccer was my whole life. For 16 years of my life, that's what I did. So coming into college, it's a different level. You know, you have to adapt and get up to speed with everything. So my freshman year was kind of a struggle. And then, honestly, I think by my senior year, I was just so burnt out because I had been playing soccer for so long. And it was just, my body hurt. Everything hurt. I needed a break. So I think senior year kind of came right at the right time for me because after that, I, you know, didn't even want to touch a soccer ball. It's like, I just need some space. But when I was in season, that's when I did the best in school because that's what I was always used to is having to time manage.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do well when I had all this free time because I would just procrastinate and keep putting stuff off. When it all ended, I definitely was ready for it to end. But I definitely had some sort of identity crisis because I lost everything that I had known for, you know, the past couple of years. So it was really weird for me because I felt like I lost soccer. I felt like I lost all my friends. I'd been in a relationship and that ended, so I lost that. So I was literally like, who am I? Everything that I've ever known has just been ripped away from me. So those couple years after school were definitely difficult, but I think I grew a lot as a person. I finally got to say, you know, what do I enjoy doing for fun? Because everyone's like, oh, you know, what's your hobby? What do you do? And soccer was always the answer. And now it isn't anymore. So I just kind of had to like do some soul searching and just figure out what makes me happy and how I like to spend my free time and stuff like that. So it actually, it sucked at the time, but I think it was for the best.
It was my biggest part of my identity for my entire life. And anytime anyone would ask, like, you know, tell me something about yourself, it's the first thing I would say. And it was what made me happiest. But by the time senior year came around, I was definitely kind of like, you know, in pain, injured constantly. And definitely like big part of my brain was like ready to stop. But once I did stop, it was like losing a giant part of myself. And I think the rest of the senior year definitely tried to fill that with different things. And then especially that first year after college, when I was living back at home by myself, away from all the really close relationships I'd made at school, and really started like just kind of lost myself, like what am I supposed to do, who am I supposed to be. And it's nice to hear other people who have felt the same way, because you definitely do feel alone when you're in those types of situations. But talk a little bit more about after you lost soccer and kind of your friends are still at school, some of the new relationships you made.
I think it sort of forced me to put more of an effort in to see people, because I wasn't in Hamden anymore. I was back at home. So I pretty much every weekend I was like, where am I going? What am I doing? Who am I visiting? I mean, I was up in Boston. I was down in the city. I was down at Hamden. I went up to New Hampshire to see a friend. Like, I was just everywhere and anywhere, trying to do stuff, trying to just keep myself busy, but also reconnecting with all my friends that I had been too busy for before. I spent a lot of time seeing Joe and my old roommates down in Hamden, and that was great. And then I had an opportunity that presented itself to do travel for my work, and so I ended up in Southern Indiana for 3 months, and that was a very interesting experience. But I never would have done that if I had, you know, still been in that relationship or still had all my friends at school. Like, I had no ties keeping me here. I was like, why not pick up and move? And that was a really scary experience for me. I don't deal with change very well. I knew no one there. I basically had to start over completely. And that was a really big point in my life. And because of that, when I came back home, I, you know, was still looking to travel. I ended up finding Greenwich Hospital and moved down here. And I think that was one of the best moves that I've made. So it's been really great to have all of that come together after how unsure I was of where I was gonna end up, because I was still living at home for, you know, about a year and a half after college. And I was like, I can't live at home for 3 more years. You know, I really just have to get out. And it was scary to move out here, definitely, because I didn't really know anyone in Stanford. I lived alone, so it was hard to make new friends, but just kind of jumped in. Now I have a great group of friends here. And like I said, I have all the people in the city, and that's how we became so close again. And really worked out.
When you did move to Indiana, it was definitely random. And that's like, not only is it you're going by yourself, living by yourself in a new place where you don't know anyone, but it's also, I mean, the middle of nowhere where it's not like you had a ton of things to do to distract yourself. So just talk a little bit more about just like kind of coming to terms with being alone there and like the help that had moving forward, living by yourself with, you know, just with your cat.
Yeah. I've always been good at being alone, but that really taught me how to be alone and be content with myself and to not need other people around, to be constantly talking to someone, to not, you know, have that constant support. It was like every weekend I had no plans. For New Year's, you know, one of the women I worked with, she had me over to her house for a New Year's party, and I was hanging out with 40-year-old women, and it was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just different experiences, and not a lot of it is something that people would consider fun, right? Because they're used to New York City, going to rooftops, going out to bars, and I think there was one bar in the entire town. Mm-hmm. So it was just a very different lifestyle, but it was interesting to see a different perspective and a different, you know, kind of culture.
I remember at the time I was like, how is she doing this? I just, you know, she didn't know where to go out, there's nothing to do. And I mean, I think just COVID put everyone in Southern Indiana for the past 4 months, because it's been nothing to do, nothing, you know, complete lifestyle change. And it was really just like a good warm up for you there to learn how to like be content with yourself and just kind of be at peace with what you have, as opposed to, you know, your expectations of, you know, I should be going out on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, nights and you know, doing all this crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. And then just like kind of leading up to, you know, the main part of this story, but just talk a little bit about our friend group. I know for me, it's been, you know, a huge part of my story, just having a group of people who I trust, who I know I can go to with anything, and they're not going to judge me. People I know, I'm very confident with how much they like me being around, how much they like me as a person, how much they care about me, which is really like the biggest reason I was able to even do this company, knowing that even if I fail, you know, I still have all of you guys, so I don't really care. So just talk a little bit, you know, your experience with our friend group, and, you know, I know you have multiple friend groups, you're very popular, but the one we, you know, the one that we hang out with in the city, a lot of times.
Yeah. So having a big friend group is very new to me. Growing up, I played sports, but I was not in with the popular crowd. You know, I was friends with them because they all played sports, but I wouldn't say that, you know, I had like this huge friend group that I could always hang out with. So it's definitely been an adjustment for me with our friend group in New York City, because I've never had so many friends in one group that I get along with and that I enjoy spending so much time with, and that want me around as well. So it's been probably one of the best things in my life currently, having this huge friend group down there, and it just makes it so we always have something to do. You know, there's always people to talk to. There's always some people that want to get together. Like, maybe we don't have everyone get together every single time, but just having that support system and all those people to go and see, and we always have a fun time.
And just, if you want to just talk a little bit more, and I know, I guess, tell the story the way you want to tell it from, I guess, the Galantis concert through.
Yeah, so we were in the city for Valentine's Day, our big friend group. We went to a concert, Galantis, highly recommend. Probably one of the best nights of my life was that concert. It was so fun. We had all of our friends there. The next night, we were celebrating a couple people's birthdays. So we all went out, had a huge dinner. That was so fun. And then, you know, come back from the city, it's exhausting. So by Monday morning, I was just completely wiped out. Went to work, came home, went to the gym because I didn't get to go to the gym in the morning Monday because I was so exhausted from the city. Was just hanging out in the apartment. I get a call from my mom, which is totally normal to happen on a Monday after a weekend because she wants to know how my weekend was. So I didn't think anything of it. And Monday had actually been Veterans Day or something. It was some sort of holiday because she had the day off. And so I answer the phone, and as soon as she starts talking, I can immediately tell that something's wrong. So she tells me that my dad had been in an accident. He was running and was hit by a car. And so her voice is kind of shaky. I said, you know, well, what is he okay? Like, what's going on? So she said that she was in the hospital with him. He was in the ER. They were doing a bunch of tests, doing some CAT scans, and they thought that he had like a little fracture in his leg, some broken vertebrae in his neck, and then his right eye was swollen shut. And they didn't really know much else, but it didn't sound all that bad. So I asked my mom, like, do you need me to come home? Should I come home tonight? And she said, oh no, you know, it's fine. Your aunt and uncle are here with me. I think everything will be okay. And I said, okay. So I hung up. She called me back like an hour or two later, and I had friends coming over because we watched The Bachelor on Monday nights. So we always host. And so I had a bunch of people coming over, and I didn't really want to cancel on everyone last minute, say, oh, you guys can't come over anymore. I have to go home or whatever. But she called me back and she was like, you know, I think it might be a little worse than we were thinking. Maybe you should come home tonight. So I said, you know, I have some friends coming over. Once they leave, I'll drive home. I couldn't focus the entire time that I was watching the show with them. I don't know why I didn't just tell them all to leave. I definitely should have, but made it through the show. They all left. I immediately jumped in the car and drove home. My roommate had offered to drive me, and I was like, you have to work tomorrow. You stay, like, I'll be fine. Mm-hmm. So I drove home. I got to the hospital about midnight. My aunt and uncle were there. My other aunt and uncle had driven down from Vermont to come back. So we were all just hanging out in the waiting room. We couldn't go in to see him because they were doing some procedures on him. And they all left around 2 a.m. My mom and I stayed the night there. So they had these, you know, little couches that we just spread out on. And some of the nurses brought us some blankets, which was really nice. Mm. We couldn't get in touch with my brother. He had been in Texas, I think, climbing. But he was there for work and then was staying a couple extra days to climb. And so, you know, everything starts running through my mom's head. She's like, great, my husband got hit by a car. My son fell off a cliff. Like, this is awesome. He ended up having just gotten home and passed out and didn't look at his phone for hours. Right. So the next morning we got a hold of him at like 6 a.m., told him what had happened. So he drove down. We got to go home and take a little rest. The next couple of days, honestly, all sort of blend together. I think that first morning, I finally got to go in and see him. And, you know, for someone who got hit by a car, he looked pretty good. His right eye was swollen shut, but all his limbs were intact. He had, like, barely any scrapes and stuff. They did have a metal rod going into his head. It was to check his cranial pressures to make sure that his brain wasn't swelling too much. That's kind of when we learned that there was more going on under the surface, mm-hmm. Than we had originally thought. So then we got to go home for a little bit. We came back later that morning and, you know, met with some of the doctors, kind of went over everything that was going on with my dad. So they basically told us, you know, externally things are pretty much fine. Internally, not so much. So there wasn't really any internal bleeding, but when he had gotten hit, he hit the right side of his head on the car windshield, which caused his brain to hit the left side of his head and then come back. So just, you know, like a very severe concussion. But he had some, you know, hemorrhage into his brain. When they had found him on the scene, the whole right side of his body was not working. It was paralyzed because his left side had been affected so bad. That's what controls the whole right side of your body. So we didn't really know, you know, if he gets through all of this, will he even have function of the right side of his body? You know, that was a question that we didn't know how all of that would pan out. Right. So then over the next couple of days, they just, you know, were monitoring him with the brain pressure. That ended up getting to a dangerous level because his brain was swelling so much. So they ended up having to bring him down for a craniectomy. So they removed the left side of his skull to allow the brain to swell out and give it some room. And that went very well. I believe on that day, I think it was Thursday, we had probably 24 people in the visiting room with us, all of our friends and family. I had a bunch of my friends from college had driven up. So that was pretty amazing to have all those people there. And the neurosurgeon said that things went very well. He said he was very cautiously optimistic, but he did have to resect a decent amount of brain tissue. And a lot of the brain tissue that was damaged was from his temporal lobe, which controls all of your speech, communication, language. So they didn't really know how affected he would be if he did wake up. They didn't know what his level of function would be, if he would even be able to understand us, if he would be able to read or write, any of that. So it was just a lot of question marks in the air. And they kept telling us, you know, hold out hope. And I think in the end, that word was, you know, yeah, you want to have hope, but to a certain extent, you know, you have to be realistic about things. and people, you know, kept telling me to stay positive, but things were bad, you know, and I don't think I fully let myself realize how bad they actually were. But I think by the following Monday, he was stable enough that I decided to go back to work. So I came back here, I think Monday to Thursday or so. And then by Thursday, you know, they had been monitoring him, checking, making sure that they were trying to slowly wean him off of sedation to see if he would wake up. And none of those tests that they were checking on him, like his brain function or any of his reflexes, were coming back positive in any way. So Thursday, we had a big conference call with all the doctors, and my mom and some of my relatives, my dad's brothers, were there. His sister had flown up from Florida. And we just had a big conference with everyone, kind of laid it all out there, and it was pretty obvious that he just wasn't going to get better and he wasn't going to wake up, and his quality of life would have been horrible. Even if he did, you know, he wouldn't be able to communicate with us. His whole right side of his body was paralyzed. I mean, my dad ran 8 marathons. So running and being mobile and being independent is, mm-hmm. is everything. So yeah. It's just, it's not the life that he would have wanted. So I'm good. So we ended up taking him off the vent.
And just talk a little bit more about, I know you said, like, at points you felt hope, but realistic hope, and I think that's important because it's something completely outside of your control. I mean, it's important, you know, when it's hope, that's something you can control. I mean, I always believe it's important to be very optimistic and hopeful, but when it's outside your control, you have to be realistic about it. Just talk a little bit more about, like, what you're feeling, you know, during this time. So let's say from the outside, looking in, like, I had never been through anything like this in my own life or anyone around me. Mm-hmm. I'm very fortunate with that. And I know it was a common feeling amongst our friends. Like, obviously, it was a tragedy. And we, you know, talked about how we could be there for you in the best way that, you know, for you. And so we tried to, like, have a small group reaching out to you and then filtering, sending things out to other people so you weren't bombarded. And obviously, there's plenty of times that you didn't want to talk to anyone. And just from, you know, for friends of people going through tragedies out there, what helped you get through it? What did you appreciate about, you know, things that your friends and family did? And, like, what were you feeling, you know, during all of this?
Yeah. So definitely having the support of people there was huge. I mean, we were never alone when we were at the hospital, and most of the time we couldn't even go and see my dad, but we'd get to the hospital by like 10 a.m. and we'd leave at 6, so we'd spend an entire day there, and we'd have so many people coming in and just sitting with us, and it was nice to have that distraction, so you weren't constantly thinking about it. And, you know, we brought like card games in, and we had drawing things to do, just stuff to keep you occupied and not thinking about it. But I needed to be there at the hospital. I think I never really had anxiety before this, but I didn't sleep very well the first couple of nights. I think I got like 10 hours of sleep total the first 3 nights. And I didn't feel okay until I was at the hospital and I had spoken to one of the nurses and I knew that he had, you know, made it through the night and was still okay. Mm-hmm. So just the anxiety that came from that, I was barely eating, I couldn't work out, I wasn't sleeping, and people kept telling me, you know, like, take care of yourself, you can't get run down, you need to eat, you need to sleep. And I didn't really listen to them, and I should have, because I ended up getting really sick. I was completely wiped out. I was throwing up. I couldn't even go into the hospital. One of those days I just had to stay home. So, you know, having that support from everyone was huge, and just having people be there. And the idea that you said where we, you know, I would communicate with one or two people and then they'd kind of filter the information out. That was probably the best. decision that we made, because it was overwhelming to get all those text messages. And I know that so many people cared, but it was just too much for me to be constantly typing out these same conversations over and over again.
Just reliving it.
And, you know, every time I had to type it out, it hurt more and more. So having those friends that just sort of took control of that and just sort of dispersed it was really great. And then just the support afterwards as well, like at the wake. I think we had about 600 people come through. It was crazy. And it was kind of weird because people would come up and they'd be crying and I wasn't, because it was almost heartwarming and just really nice to hear all these nice things and these stories that people had about him, and to see the amount of people that he had touched and interacted with. So many people that he worked with that I never even met were coming up to me and telling me all these stories and talking to me about how much he talked about my brother and I to them. They were like, you know, we've never met you or your brother, but we feel like we know you because of how much he talked about you. They're like, he was so proud of you, all your accomplishments. This one woman came up to me and she's like, I need to know how it ends. She said, the last time I spoke to your dad, you were headed off to college. And like, what did you end up doing? So it was really funny in a way. And it was really touching. And I think it helped a lot of us cope with it better. And my mom and I would talk about this. My mom and I are very much on the same page about everything that happened. And we have the same thoughts and ideas. So going through all of it with her, and having someone else to talk about it with that understood exactly, was a great support system. And we both, you know, really appreciated all the support and everyone that showed up. And it kind of, I know for my mother, it made her rethink, you know, if someone else is going through a tragedy, I need to be there. She said, you know, there's been times in the past that I haven't gone to the hospital to be with someone. And she said, you know, never again, because seeing how many people showed up for us and how much it helped definitely changes how we would treat, you know, someone else in a similar situation and how we would be there for them.
Absolutely. And I never met your dad, but just, you know, driving up from the city to his service, and I was blown away by how many people were there. We got there towards what we thought was going to be the end of it. We had a ton of traffic, and the line was out the door around the block.
Two hours long.
And I was jokingly asking where the VIP line was. And it was cool, not cool, but it was heartwarming to wait in line and listen to kind of like unfiltered conversations about your dad from people around town who just showed up, and you know, whatever level of knowing him they did. But just, I heard, everything I heard was just, you know, he's the nicest guy. He's just such positive things, and it was just cool to hear, obviously knowing you so well, knowing your mom as well, just seeing the type of dad that he was, the type of human he was. And beyond that, I'll say, like, I was very anxious when me and Joe were driving up to visit in the hospital, which was like, you know, half the weekend in between the accident and when he passed. And because I, again, never been in that situation, and so I didn't really know how to be there for someone, how you would be, and because I'm very dumb.
Inappropriate jokes.
Very dumb personality, and I tend to make bad, inappropriate jokes at times. I remember I was just so much anxiety about, like, you know, do I just like act normal with Kelly, or do I, you know, try and filter my personality? And I remember walking in and I was wearing all black, and I was walking in, I was like, oh fuck, oh shit, like I'm the Grim Reaper, and like she's gonna think, you know, all these things. And and then we got up there and just seeing like the strength of you and your mom and the rest of your family, but specifically you and your mom, was one of the most inspiring things I've ever seen in my life. You know, that, you know, we stayed at the hospital that night and we put games, and, you know, you were, I don't want to say normal, but it was just like, you know, normal Kelly. And at times, you know, you walked away and had your moments where you wanted to be alone. And, but just the strength that both of you had, that you were explaining the situation to us, You know, you're bringing us in to see your dad, and really it was inspiring for me that that someone could be going through this tragedy. I tried to put myself into your shoes and think, you know, if this was my dad or my mom or my brother or my sister, like, how would I be feeling? And I don't think I would have had the strength to be doing what you and your mom are doing, which was making everyone feel calm, making everyone feel normal. And so that was honestly left an imprint on me going forward. It was really inspiring.
Yeah. And if anything that comes out of this, if I can help one person going through something like this, then, you know, it's worth it. And my dad leaves behind so much of a legacy. But if, you know, he can teach me one last thing as to how to help people get through situations like this, then, you know, that means everything.
Absolutely. It's really powerful and just shows the type of person that you are. Because it does take an enormous amount of strength to talk about. We can talk about this. And this was, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, this was recent. This was not years ago. This was
4 months ago.
And I really do, I mean, again, just the amount of courage you have, and just to do it in one take without even without crying once. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, if I had cried, we would have had to stop. There would be no more video because my face would be very red. So there was no crying allowed. But I think the more that I've talked about it with people, the easier it's gotten. I mean, it obviously still hits me at random times, but I'm okay. Like, I can talk about it without breaking down, and I can tell people how I'm feeling, which I wasn't always able to before. Mm-hmm. So I think this whole experience has just helped me be more comfortable with myself and how I'm feeling and my emotions. And I have a couple friends who have lost their dads, and so talking to them was the biggest help through this entire thing, because they know exactly what I'm going through, and I feel like you can't really know until you're going through it. And the best advice they gave me was, you know, everyone kept telling me, oh, be strong, you know, you have to be strong. And they were like, uh-uh, you feel however you want to feel. Mm-hmm. You do whatever you want to do. No one knows what you're going through. They can't tell you how to feel. If you want to scream, go ahead and scream. If you want to cry, absolutely. Do whatever you need to do. You don't need to be strong and hold yourself together all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think I definitely try to be strong and hold myself together in front of people and in public. But I mean, as my roommate can probably tell you, and a lot of my friends, I definitely break down, you know, behind closed doors. And there's very few people that I really let see that. But I think that's okay. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to stay strong, you know, and hold yourself high, but you're also allowed to break down and have those moments.
Mm-hmm. There's no shame ever in any feelings. It's just how we feel. You can't control that. Mm-hmm. There's no way to relate to something like that. There really isn't, unless you've been through it, which is why it's so important to have, you know, talk to people who have been through it. Which is really the whole goal of this, is so that anyone else out there who's struggling with this or going through it right now, or has gone through it through the past and gone through it in the past and still struggling with it, like, listening to people who've gone through it, it helps so much. I hear constantly. And then just like transitioning, obviously that was, right before, you know, the whole quarantine and COVID. I think your service was on March 3rd. Mm-hmm. And your quarantine started right after that. You worked at a hospital, so you had lost your job as well for a brief amount of time. So if you just want to talk a little bit about dealing with the tragedy while also being alone, and how you coped with it, and you know, just that whole period.
Yeah, so COVID hit, and you know, things really slowed down at my job. Was just kind of stuck home with not much to do. And like we talked about before, I had all these experiences being alone and being comfortable with myself. And so I think those helped me a lot get through this time, because I think normal people during COVID are anxious, you know, somewhat depressed and just alone with their thoughts. And it's a lot to comprehend. Someone going through a tragedy like this, where you have all of that, it's even more heightened. Mm-hmm. I think I already knew how to cope with some things because of my being comfortable being by myself. So yeah, I mean, it was definitely hard. There were definitely days that I just wouldn't really get out of bed, because I didn't have to. I didn't have to go to work. I didn't have to do anything that day. So why bother? Once my job did pick back up a little bit, that was great for me, because it was a good distraction. And so I was only working about 3 days a week then, but they were 12-hour days. I was constantly interacting with people, but being back in the hospital was definitely hard. I was thrown into the labor pool, which means they just reassigned me to whatever floor needed help. And a lot of the times they placed me in the ICU. So seeing these patients on vents, was really triggering and, really just reminded me of my dad. So that was pretty difficult to be there and see these patients in such critical condition and know that my dad had been going through a very similar thing. Even now, you know, we do some ultrasounds on some very sick patients, and anytime I have to go up and I see a patient that's vented, it just kind of reminds me of my dad. But I've been better, you know, each day gets a little bit easier, but I'm just trying to take it, you know, one day at a time and get more comfortable and get back into things. And I think, you know, I'm slowly getting there. But yeah, the whole pandemic, definitely not a great time to just have had something very horrible happen and then be stuck alone. You know, I really haven't been able to see my family. My mom didn't want me to come home because I work in the hospital.
Right.
Understandable. You know, I got invited to a family barbecue, but I had to sit in the corner of the yard as far away from everyone as possible. So it was definitely very isolating.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, things are better now and got through it, basically. But I think it definitely helped me having those prior experiences of being alone and knowing how to cope with those feelings.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What advice would you give to someone who is right in the middle of maybe just after the point where your dad had been in the accident, someone who's right in that, in the middle of the tragedy and trying to figure out how to deal with it and why, you know, asking themselves why this is happening and trying to make sense of all the chaos?
Talk to people. I know it might not seem like you want to at the time, but if you have, you know, that family member or that friend that will just listen, you know, they don't need to say anything. If you just talk about it and talk it through with them and just, you know, kind of lay your feelings out there, that really helped me. Just having those people that I could go to and, you know, no one will get annoyed with you for talking about it. And I feel like over the past couple weeks, you know, as it gets more and more time between the incident and the present, I feel like people sometimes get annoyed with me for bringing it up constantly, or, you know, they're going to say, that's all she talks about. You know, it's been 4 months, like, not move on, but, you know, you can't keep breaking down like this. But none of my friends have said that to me, and none of them ever will. So I think just those thoughts in my mind that people don't want to listen to me or don't care, those are just negative thoughts and they're not real. So you just have to remind yourself that, like, you have those friends for a reason and they're there for you and they want to be there for you. And they might not always reach out because they know that you're going through a tough time and they don't want to bring it up if you're having a good day, and set you back. But having those friends is really important. Really important.
I hear it constantly, especially in this process of talking to these people. We're afraid to bring up our problems. People in our brains tell us that people don't care or that our story is not as valuable as someone else's. And so, you know, just forces us to keep it to ourselves. But when you separate yourself from those thoughts, you start seeing, you know, this is not true. They're not true thoughts. Like, your friends, of course, care about you. Your friends want to be there to help you however they can be, whether that's listening or doing whatever they can for you. But you do have to reach out and ask for help a lot of times, because either people are living their own lives and they just don't think about it, which is, you know, normal, or like you said, they don't want to bring it up and they don't know how to bring it up and they've never been in that type of situation. And everyone's problems matter. Everyone matters. And especially when you're in a tragedy, in the middle of a tragedy like this that you have no control over, it's so important to ask for help and bring it up. But it's just everyone I talk to, whenever they're talking about their own personal problems, they say the same thing. It's like, I don't feel like they're as valuable as that person's problems, or that person just doesn't care. And it's just these fake thoughts in our head and all of our heads. And it's so important for us to share them so that we can all realize that it happens to all of us. And it's just not true. It's just how our brains work, how our generation grew up and constantly comparing ourselves to others. And friends don't think like that. Friends aren't saying, you know, Joanna's problems are worse than Kelly's problems. Kelly, don't talk to me. You know, it's just silly when you put it, when you think about it and look at the thoughts from above. What's important to you? What's your why? What like makes you excited to get up every day? And has it changed through this tragedy, or has your this tragedy given you any perspective on that?
Definitely given me perspective. You know, life's too short, obviously. That's a cliche, but it really is. I mean, my dad ran that route every single day, like hundreds of times that he's run that route. And, you know, my mom kept saying, you know, what if he stopped to tie his shoe? Or what if he had left 5 minutes earlier? This never would have happened. But, you know, everything sort of happens for a reason. I don't want to get into the whole thing, but my dad had some other stuff going on. And we got some test results back on him that showed some signs of early onset Alzheimer's. So who knows, you know, what the next 10, 15 years with him would have been like. So I guess, you know, he's just kind of given me strength to get up every day and to just live my life and do these things. And I think my mom is the exact same way, because she just bought a 3-wheel motorcycle. You know, she's not stopping her life. She's not being cautious. Like, she's just going out and doing whatever makes her happy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've made more of a commitment to myself to work out every morning. I had kind of fallen off of that, but you know, it's like, and I want to get back into running because I feel sort of connected with my dad when I run. And I've had this nagging injury for 3 years, so I'm really trying to rehab that, get back to running. My brother's been training for a marathon. He wants to rerun all of the marathons that my dad did.
Awesome.
So I think all of us as a family, it's just sort of motivated us a little bit more to just keep doing what we love. Mm-hmm. And you never know when it's your time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, just to add in, Nick's strength as well. I've said it's my first time meeting Nick, so it's not the best circumstances to meet, but his strength as well. I just wanted to add that. And just one other thing I wanted to ask, because it just, I know you said it, and I just know it from knowing you, how, you know, great of a job your parents did raising you. And if you talk about, like, the belief that they had in you, I mean, for you to be, like, the person you wanted to be, and, like, how important that was for you to be confident in your own skin. Like, you, as long as I've known you, you've always been a very confident person, very, you know, just, you know how to be yourself, and you're not usually worried what other people think of you. And I think a lot of that just comes from people around you kind of instilling that belief in yourself. And I think it's really important for people to believe in themselves, and for the people around us to believe in us, to do whatever we want to do, whatever we're passionate about. If you just want to, like, touch on that.
Yeah, I think they just supported me and my brother in whatever we wanted to do. And they didn't, you know, shy away from something because it was unconventional or a little weird. You know, it was like, oh, you want to play the trumpet? Sure, we'll get you trumpet lessons. You know, they wanted us to be happy kids, and they just supported us in any way. I think a lot of the not caring about what other people think kind of came from my mom, because she grew up on a farm in Minnesota. So she was not used to, you know, the fancy lifestyle of clothes and bags and who has what. And so when I was growing up, I never got the cool clothes. You know, she was like, why am I spending $50 on a t-shirt when I could get five for that price? So And my parents, both of them were very like that. I mean, my dad would always say, the best thing you can get me is nothing. He's like, stop spending my money. So they both were just kind of like very simple. They didn't want us to not be someone, you know, not be who we're not. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they just supported us and yeah.
Amazing. And just, I'll just say it again, knowing your mom, Susie, just amazing person, obviously, raised two amazing kids, and just from being at the service and hearing, from the outside about your dad, just amazing people all around. So, I'm really blessed that they are all amazing people, raised an amazing person, and that you're in my life, because, you make my life better for sure. And I'll think all of our friends would share that opinion. So, thank you so much for having the strength to share this story with me and with everyone out there listening. And thank you so much for being a good friend and always being there for me. And I hope really does come from hearing other people's experiences. And really, really blessed that you're willing to share yours today. And I hope you keep sharing it with whoever needs it. And keep being the great friend that you are.
Thanks. It's always nice to hear. Thanks for having me. I really enjoy being here, and I hope that this helps someone listening with, you know, whatever they're going through. And if anyone wants to reach out to me, more than happy to talk to someone personally about it.
Mm-hmm. You want to plug your Instagram?
Sure. Kelly F Baby 3. I hate saying that. I really need to change it. Yeah. No tears.
No tears.
I got close at one point.
Oh. That was great.
Okay.
I'm inspired.
Cool.